Good morning to you. I'm Monica Schneider. We are again going to be taking you live inside the courtroom momentarily for the murder trial of Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke and the shooting death of black teen Laquan McDonald nearly 4 years ago, October 20th, 2014. Court was canceled yesterday because one juror was sick. We're expecting the defense to continue calling witnesses today, possibly its last ones, but there's still also the open question of whether Officer Van Dyke will testify in his own defense. Police dash cam video shown repeatedly at this trial seems to favor the prosecution, as it shows McDonald being mowed down by Van Dyke seconds after he exits his police vehicle. McDonald was shot 16 times. But testimony from Van Dyke's former partner that they perceived the knife-wielding McDonald as a threat from their angle, along with also a 3D video creation purporting to show McDonald closing the distance from Van Dyke's angle, could help the defense. At any rate, it is giving jurors much to think about as to whether or not the officer is guilty of first-degree murder in what has been a very controversial and polarizing case in this city. Joining us once again to help analyze the trial from a legal perspective is attorney Gal Fisetsky. Gal, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning.
So what, when we say that the burden for the jurors now, because it is innocent until proven guilty, or it's supposed to be, and the dash cam video certainly was seemed like a prosecution slam dunk, but then you have these other elements that the defense has been able to bring in, and then you have the law, which has been brought up at this trial in numerous ways. The defense called, for instance, during some testimony last week, called a Chicago Police Department attorney who teaches at the police academy about when you can use deadly force. And trying to make the point that if you fear that the person you're after, this in this case McDonald with a knife, could get away, wouldn't be able to be arrested, you can use deadly force, according to this person. But how would the jury see that?
Well, it's an interesting question that you're asking, because the law is given to the jurors at the end by the judge. And the judge is going to tell them, I'm giving you jury instructions, and whatever it is here on the jury instructions, that's what you must follow.
Mm-hmm.
You heard testimony, and it's simply testimony, and you can determine whether or not the witnesses are credible or the witnesses are not credible. But at the end of the day, the law that I'm giving you...
We're seeing inside the courtroom just the people sitting in court today, kind of a sweep look at some of the people there. There's our Julie Unruh from WGN, a reporter, other people also in the courtroom. But the judge, and there's Dan Herbert, defense attorney for Van Dyke. Basically, you're saying whatever the attorneys are saying, at the end of the day, the judge is going to tell the jurors, this is what you base your decision on, this
Correct.
Law.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's listen in.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning.
Would you please introduce yourself and spell your last name?
Lawrence Miller, Ph.D., M-I-L-L-E-R.
And, doctor, what is your profession?
Psychologist.
What is a psychologist?
Psychologist is a doctoral-level professional who is trained in the science of human behavior and its applications to clinical treatment, assessment, evaluation, and broader applications to things like business, forensics, and so on.
Doctor, how long have you been practicing psychology?
As a licensed psychologist for 28 years, as a trainee or graduate student, doctoral student for about another 5 or 6 years. So overall, over 30 years.
And doctor, are there different branches of psychology?
Well, there are a number of branches of psychology. The ones that I currently am in practice in include clinical psychology, which is the evaluation and treatment of various types of patients, what most people are familiar with when they think of a psychologist or a psychotherapist. Another area of specialization is neuropsychology, which deals with the brain and behavior. And here we're evaluating and in some cases treating individuals with a variety of brain syndromes. And these could be children with learning disabilities, older individuals with different types of dementias, individuals who have been in accidents and received a traumatic brain injury, and so on. Another field is forensic psychology, which is kind of what we're doing here today, which is the application of psychology to matters of the law. So those are the three main branches of psychology that I'm currently involved in my clinical practice.
Okay. And you mentioned clinical psychology, neuropsychology, and forensic psychology. My question is, in any of these fields, have you ever been retained as an expert before?
Yes.
In addition to your clinical and forensic practice, do you engage in other professional activities?
I also am an instructor at Florida Atlantic University, where I teach a variety of courses in psychology, including some of those fields I just mentioned. I'm also a researcher, and I've published several papers and books in the field of psychology, again, on similar topics.
And Doctor, you talked about the three different fields of psychology. I want to ask you about police psychology. What is police psychology?
Police psychology is a field that essentially has emerged beginning about 30 years ago out of some of these different branches, primarily from clinical psychology, which is involved in different types of evaluations and assessments, and also forensic psychology, which obviously, for when it deals with matters of law enforcement, deals with applications of psychology to the law.
And do you have some examples of that, or are those pretty much what you just gave us?
There are three main, I would say, branches or domains of police psychology, and including the ones that I'm involved in. The first can be called clinical services, and here psychologists might be involved in doing things like evaluations following an officer-involved shooting, a fitness for duty evaluation, providing specialized clinical services to police officers who are in distress in some way. It may be family issues, suicide prevention, and so on. So in some senses, it's applying the normal assessment and treatment techniques of psychology, but applying them to this unique population. Another branch of police psychology is what we call operational assistance. And here, psychologists use their expertise in behavioral science and human nature to assist police officers in things like investigation, interview and interrogation, hostage negotiation, undercover work. So it's called operational because psychology is assisting these officers in what they actually do as police officers. And the third main area is consultation and training, and that's another area that I'm involved in, which is training police officers and police managers in various subjects such as conflict resolution, stress management, nonviolent negotiation, and so on. So in my own practice, I'm less involved in the operational assistance part, more involved in the clinical services and the training and consultation.
Doctor, how long have you practiced in the area of police psychology?
In that particular area, approximately 20 years.
Have you provided any agencies services in the past?
Well, consultation and training services I provide pretty much around the country on an as-needed basis, and even some of the other services that involve assessment and testimony, as obviously I'm doing here today. But the agencies that I work with most consistently are the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office in Palm Beach County, Florida, the West Palm Beach Police Department in West Palm Beach, Florida, and more on a consultant basis with the Florida Highway Patrol, particularly Troop L.
Doctor, what kind of services do you provide as a police psychologist?
Well, as I just mentioned, this is evaluating officers after shootings or other what are called critical incidents. And here, the objective is when an officer has been involved in a deadly force encounter, whether or not it resulted in an actual fatality, in addition to the obvious administrative processes that an officer has to go through, when they're administratively cleared, they're typically sent to me just to do a kind of assessment to see if they're mental status is intact. Essentially, it's a psychological equivalent of checking the points and plugs, making sure that these officers are not experiencing any unusual reactions, any problems with obsessive rumination, sleep loss, and so on. And typically, within a few days following an otherwise uncontested officer-involved shooting, these guys and gals are pretty much good to go. They may report some strange phenomena that took place during the shooting episode itself, or even if it's not a shooting, during some other type of encounter. And some after reactions that they had in the last couple of days. But these are phenomena that are almost universally reported by most officers who have been in this type of life and death encounter.
Doctor, you talked about how you've provided services for officers that have been involved in use of force. Have you ever conducted evaluations for officers that were accused of excessive force?
Yes.
Let me ask you this. Is there a difference between clinical and forensic use of force psychological evaluation?
Well, in fact, There are a few officers I've had in my practice where I was not an objectively evaluating expert. I was actually a primary clinical therapist for officers who were undergoing investigation, lawsuits, legal action, and so on. And there, my job is, as with any patient who's undergoing a stressful circumstance, to assist that officer in dealing and coping with the stresses involved in this type of investigation. So that would be an example of the clinical approach. What I'm doing here today, by having done an evaluation and testifying to the results of that evaluation, that would obviously fall more in the forensic realm, because we're dealing here with matters of the law.
And doctor, when you conduct your evaluations in formulating your conclusions, what are the data bases that you draw upon to render your opinions?
Well, doing any kind of psychological evaluation involves certain steps, and they're fairly similar to the steps that are involved in doing an evaluation of a police officer. First, we want to get as much background as we can in terms of reviewing records, getting a history, finding out the context of what that person is ultimately going to tell me. And then, of course, the meat of the evaluation, the substance of it, is the clinical interview, in which the subject is asked a variety of questions. They're given the opportunity to tell their story in their own words. They're given follow-up questions and trying to get as much of what that individual recalls about the incident as possible. And in some cases, not in a case like this particularly, there may also be some specialized tests and measures that are utilized. But in a officer-involved shooting case like this, there really isn't any kind of psychometric test that you can give a person to assess these things. So the data points from the officer, him or herself, rely pretty much on what that officer tells us.
Doctor, is there any scientific literature on the psychology of police use of force?
Well, one of the things I want to make clear today is that just about all of what I'm going to be testifying to in the area of police psychology grows out of a much larger field that goes back almost a century on the psychology and neuroscience of the brain's response to emergency situations, because pretty much everyone has been in a circumstance where suddenly they're confronted by a threatening circumstance. They have to act quickly. In most cases, it turns out okay. And then we go back and figure, wow, what just happened? We may have certain experiences. The adrenaline is rushing. We have some memory gaps that we're having difficulty explaining later. But somehow we get ourselves through that circumstance and we're able to talk about it later. So the main difference is, for most of us, if we're faced with danger, our brains are telling us, do whatever you can to get away from the danger. If your car is skidding off the road, correct it. If someone is chasing you, elude them. If the house is on fire, get out of it. First responders, which includes firefighters and police officers, their task is a little different, because even though their brains are telling them, run, get away, save yourself, their job is exactly to do the opposite. They have to run towards the danger. The firefighter has to run into the burning building. The police officer has to confront the armed assailant, because the lives of other people are at stake. So what that does, more so than the average civilian like you and I, is heighten that danger, heighten that threat level, and therefore the types of reactions that we see are probably a little more common.
And doctor, you have consulted on legal cases concerning police use of force?
Yes.
Approximately how many cases have you consulted on?
Consulted on about six or seven cases, testified to about four or five cases.
And in your cases that you've consulted and testified on, have you testified consistently for one side or the other?
Well, typically, as in a case like this, I'm retained by the defense, because if this is a contested shooting, a lot of what the defense boils down to is what was that officer's perception during the time of that deadly force encounter.
And you, how many police evaluations have you done, psychological evaluations for police officers?
Well, if you add up all the different types of evaluations, at least over 100.
And we contacted you for an opinion in this case, correct?
Yes.
And my question is, have you ever been retained by a particular party and not provided the opinion that party was looking for?
Well, I don't know about not providing the opinion. There have been a couple of cases I've been consulted on where either by a typically my procedure is if an attorney wants to retain me, I'll have that attorney send me a sort of summary of the case so I can familiarize myself and even see if this is a case that I want to get involved in. If it looks like something I want to get involved in, or may possibly, what I will do is I will do a conduct a full evaluation of that police officer, as I did in this case, and then put those findings together and discuss those findings with the attorney. And in most cases, if I've satisfied myself from the preliminary information that this might be a good case, then I will move on and take the case. But there have been at least one case where, based on just a preliminary review of records, it wasn't a case that I could support based on my understanding of psychology and policing. And there have been at least one other case where I did a full evaluation and at the very end declined to testify because I couldn't support what that officer was telling me based on that attorney's theory of that case.
And doctor, that was the procedure here. We contacted you and...
Oh, this is a still preliminary in nature, overrule.
And doctor, that was the process here. We contacted you and you told us that...
I'm sorry what he told you, all right? That's hearsay.
Okay.
Right, move on.
You conducted an analysis in this case, correct?
An evaluation, yes.
Thank you. And have you ever been accepted as an expert in the field of psychology?
Yes.
Okay. And have you ever not been accepted as an expert when you have been tendered as such?
No.
Your Honor, at this time, I would like to certify Dr. Miller as an expert.
I'm sorry, rephrase. You don't certify any.
You're right.
There you go.
I would like to have Dr. Miller declared an expert in the area of forensic and police psychology.
Thank you. State?
No objection, Your Honor.
Thank you. I find that Dr. Miller is qualified to testify in the area of forensic and police psychology.
Doctor, would you please tell the ladies and gentlemen of the jury what information you reviewed in preparation for rendering an opinion in this case?
Well, as you know, in many cases like this, I will receive a huge packet of records. So I did review police reports. I reviewed postmortem reports. I watched videos, reviewed witness statements. I can't recall every single piece of paper that I reviewed, but I reviewed pretty much all of the material that was sent to me by your office in preparation for this case.
And, doctor, you prepared a PowerPoint regarding your analysis in this case. Is that correct?
Well, certain portions of it, yes.
Okay. And would that PowerPoint help you explain to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury some of your methodology in conducting your evaluation?
Well, not so much the methodology, because I think I've explained that just a few moments ago. But what I want the jury to understand is when we talk about the different types of perceptual and thinking.
Doctor, thank you. All right, rephrase your question. The doctor said he testified about his methodology, so rephrase and ask him a question. Doctor, answer the question, please.
Sure. Regarding your methodology that you...
Well, he's testified to that, and he said that's when he corrected you.
All right,
so ask another question.
Judge, at this time I would like to mark as defendant exhibit number 19, and we have provided it to the state, and we'd like to publish it to the jury. It's the PowerPoint prepared by Dr. Miller in this case.
So this will aid the doctor in his testimony?
Yes, Judge.
Okay, thank you.
Thank
All right,
you.
Any objections?
Well, I believe you just said it would matter.
No, just in methodology. Pay attention, say. All right?
My objection is yes, it indicated that they didn't matter.
Whatever. Go ahead. You can publish.
Thank you. Okay, doctor, here. Here we have the first slide. This is your heading, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
You can advance it, please.
Okay.
All right, so...
Objection, Your Honor.
Sustained. Strike that.
Okay, so you take it off the screen, Your Honor.
Yes, take it off. All right, turn the lights on. All right. Mr. McCormick, Mr. Carroll, come on up here for a second. Excuse me right now with technical difficulties here. All right.
Okay, right after you.
So we're taking a little bit of a time out. Judge Vincent Van Gaughen can get testy about different things. As you heard, the defense was starting to present some evidence related to this witness. It's called a psychology expert on police psychology. And then the prosecution objected at one point. The judge is basically like, whatever, let's move on. But now calling into question something that they wanted to publish as evidence for the jury. Gal with me, Gal Pasitsky, a criminal defense attorney here in Chicago. So what's your take on what's happening?
Well, the defense is trying to put this slideshow that will assist
the doctor in the testimony.
However, yeah. The first slide, which is a little bit bizarre to me, because usually when you set up a slideshow, you have to show the slideshow to the opposing counsel first to make sure there's no going to be any objections in front of the jury.
This is like both sides have to know what the evidence is, right, that
correct.
The other side has. And this is before we ever get into the courtroom.
Before we even get to the courtroom. In the morning, let's say it's a brand new slideshow that they made up last night.
Uh-huh.
In the morning, they're supposed to give a copy of the slideshow to the other side to say, this is, I'm going to go show it. If you have any objections, let's take care of it before we step in front of the jury and in front of everybody go live. But here it seems like the first slide right off the bat was objected to because there was some legal definitions. And you can't have legal definitions in a slideshow. That is the job of the judge. This is exactly
like what you were saying earlier about during this case, the defense had a police recruit trainer who is a lawyer and trains police recruits on the use of deadly force in terms of what they can do under the law. But you said when it comes right down to it, at the end of the day, once the jurors go start deliberating, the judge will say, this is the law as you will follow it, not the way one side or the other is sort of interpreting it.
Right, and here you saw the defense put on a slide with a case name and some definition that they tried to tell the jury what to do.
Mm. Okay, Dan Herbert's back up speaking again, so I suppose we can listen here. By the way, you can see Van Dyke's wife sitting there with the long blonde hair with a nun from her parish sitting next to her. Let's listen.
A person senses, thinks, does, or says is related to the interaction of brain cells or neurons in the brain. There are approximately 86 billion of these cells in your brain, each of which can have connections with up to 10,000 other neurons. So if you do the math, that's a lot of zeros. And the brain operates on time frames of a thousandth of a second. That is, every thousandth of a second, one of these neurons is sending an impulse to the next neuron in the chain, times 86 billion times 10,000 connections. And that's why when we talk about things that happen very quickly, human perception, human action, usually has a limit of about perhaps a quarter of a second. There are certain things we can do in terms of very repetitive activities. We can press a keyboard, we can pull a trigger, we can do these kinds of repetitive actions in about a quarter of a second. But the brain, in that quarter of a second, the brain has already, those neurons in the brain have already, each of them has sent at least 25 separate impulses. Can I have the next slide, please? These are just different sections of the brain we're going to come back to. The human brain has the largest area of cerebral cortex, which is basically the thinking, evaluating, and perceiving part of the brain. But the cerebral cortex, which is what makes us human, which makes intelligence possible and language possible, is built up and grows out of other structures in the brain that are responsible for taking in information and responding to it. Can I have the next slide, please?
Sure, Doctor. Moving on to the next slide, can you tell us what that slide does?
Right. In order to focus on anything, right now, everybody in this room is looking at these slides, and you're seeing the slide, you're hearing me speak, and that's because your attention is focused in a certain way. The system of brain structures that allows a person to focus their attention on this versus that is something called the reticular formation. If somebody were to walk into the courtroom or if somebody were to nudge you and say something in your ear, your attention would be focused to that incoming stimulus, not to what's on the screen. So one of the things that makes us able to handle a complex situation is to quickly and flexibly be able to focus attention in one direction, then another direction, and go back and forth in a smooth, flexible way that allows us to respond to things. If something is very important, if something is dangerous, or for that matter, very pleasant, we may have our attention fixated on that. Anybody who has watched someone playing a video game on a cell phone knows that attention can be riveted to what's at hand, and can block out pretty much anything in the attentional periphery. So there is, in fact, a part of your brain whose specific job it is to direct your sensation and behavior towards a particular purpose. Next slide, please.
Excuse me one moment. Our real-time court reporting is not working, my understanding. Michael, you available again?
All right, sir.
All right, does it look like it's working on your machine?
Yes.
Outstanding. Okay, thank you. Lights.
So okay. While the reticular formation that I just mentioned tells you how to focus your attention on something, it doesn't necessarily tell you why. That is, why should you be paying attention to what I'm saying? Why should you be paying attention to the road while you're driving? Why should you be paying attention to something happening around you? And that's because the things we pay most attention to, the things we're most likely to react to, are things that are important some way. They're either important because they're particularly good and we want to do them again, or they're particularly bad and we want to avoid them. And that is due to a set of structures that we call the limbic system, two of which are most important for our purposes. That small structure in blue called the amygdala is a part of your brain that essentially allows you to evaluate the emotional meaning of any stimulus. If somebody brings you flowers and you like it, your amygdala is saying, this is something good, and I want to remember this for future reference. If somebody threatens you in some way, or if you taste something bad, or anything else that's aversive or threatening, the amygdala says, this is something bad, and we have to remember to avoid it. Well, how do you remember to avoid it? And that's due to a structure that sits right behind it, and that's the one in pink on the bottom there called the hippocampus. What the hippocampus of your brain does is it formats incoming information so that it can be stored in the brain. It doesn't store the memory per se, but essentially it converts sensation and perception into a form that you can later store. Now, what often happens is, what's typical, is information that you are perceiving at any given moment, like right this moment, hasn't been stored in your brain yet. It takes several minutes for the hippocampus to do its work to consolidate that information. If something interrupts that formatting process, if something interferes with that, then even though you may have perceived something, it's not going to get into storage in the brain. Later, when you try to recall it and you say, I can't remember what happened, it may not be a problem with memory. It may not be a problem with retrieving a memory that was formed. You can't remember it because it didn't get into your brain in the first place. And again, imagine a situation you may have been in, that some kind of emergency situation where you had to take some kind of quick action. There, quote, wasn't time to think, unquote, and yet you did the right thing because here you are, and there are certain gaps in terms of what happened. You're never going to get those gaps back, or you may get back in an inconsistent way because essentially you aren't forming those memories. What happened was during that emergency, your amygdala was sending information straight to the response system. The memory formation in an emergency circumstance essentially becomes hijacked. The brain is saying, I don't really have time to decide whether I want to remember this for next time. If my car is skidding off the road in the snow, I've got to figure out how to get it back on the road. If someone is threatening me, I've got to figure out how to get out of there. And so the person may take action almost unconsciously, almost imperceptibly, but they may have poor or no recollection of some of the events, or perhaps a distorted recollection of the events following it. Okay. Next slide, please.
Sure. Moving on to the next slide, Doctor, can you please explain what the significance of that slide is to your evaluation?
So we're talking about paying attention, we're talking about moving toward things, escaping from things, but of course, human beings are not robots, we respond emotionally. And that tiny little structure in your brainstem called the locus coeruleus is the source of a chemical called norepinephrine, which is a chemical cousin of what we call adrenaline. So when you're in an emergency situation, just when you're trying to figure out how to save yourself, you become adrenalized. In other words, you get that flood of emotion, that fear response, that panic feeling. And this is aided by the secretion of actual adrenaline from your adrenal glands that sit atop your kidneys. So now you're in a circumstance where you're trying to focus on a threat. The part of your brain is telling you, pay attention to this, tune out everything else, your memory system has been placed on standby, and you're flooded in an ocean of emotion trying to determine what the next step in the process is going to be. Next slide, please.
Thank you, Doctor. And if you can please describe what the significance of this slide was to your evaluation.
But one of the things that we can do that no other creature we know of can do is anticipate, plan, control our actions, suppress emotions, and so on. And that's because a large part of your cerebral cortex, what is called the frontal lobe, enables you to do all of those things. So your frontal lobe enables you to plan an action, to learn from mistakes, and to generate a response later on. So when you practice something, when you practice a skill, and you practice and practice it, it becomes automatic. Those frontal lobes are enabling you to program that movement, and more importantly, to be able to think flexibly. So if you try something in one circumstance and it doesn't work, you try something else. You don't just go on and on and do the same thing. You know, somebody once said that idiocy is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. We don't do that because we have parts of our brain that allow us both to persevere at a goal when that goal is important, but yet to shift gears when it's time to change our course. Next slide, please.
Okay, Doctor. Moving on to the next slide, you can explain the significance of that.
This is actually just a picture of what's called your autonomic nervous system, sometimes called the flight or fight nervous system. And this is something that is triggered along with that structure called the locus coeruleus. And we know that when people say, I was aroused by a threatening circumstance, the reason you feel that with your body is because of all the things the autonomic nervous system does, like dilate your pupils, cause you to sweat, cause you to breathe faster, your heart rate to go up, your blood pressure to go up. These are all physiological functions associated with a threatening circumstance that if you're going to take some degree of adaptive action, you're going to have to try to overcome, utilizing, again, some of those frontal lobe mechanisms that we just mentioned. Now, bear in mind, it's taking me a long time to describe this, but this is something that's going on in your brain on a millisecond to millisecond basis. Next slide, please.
Your Honor, if I may, can I move the screen closer to the jurors? I should have done this before.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Jim. Doctor, can you please describe the significance of this slide?
Well, if everything I've discussed already wasn't enough, one of the other things that happens in a stress circumstance is you get the secretion of a variety of different hormones. A structure in the brain called the hypothalamus sends information to the pituitary gland, which we all learned in high school is the master gland of your body. And one of the hormones that is secreted during stress is a hormone called cortisol. Some of us may be familiar with the anti-inflammatory effects of a cortisone cream, which is a synthetic variation of this. But what cortisol does in the body is it mobilizes energy reserves from the liver, and it also reduces inflammation. It prepares the body to respond to and react to the aftermath of a threatening circumstance that might cause injury. So these are all the different things that are going on during normal states of being, but that are accentuated and heightened severely during a life and death encounter. Next slide, please.
Doctor, please explain the significance of this slide.
Remember, we've been talking about the input part. We're talking about what happens when you perceive things, feel things. But how do you react to things? Much of what gives learned behavior its automaticity, its rhythm, its routine, the reason you're able to do things like drive a car, play a musical instrument, do a sport, in a way that does not require you to relearn it and reprogram it each time, is because these memory programs, these motor memory programs, what is sometimes called muscle memory, even though the memory is not in your muscles, it's in your brain, this is a set of structures called the basal ganglia. So this is responsible for the programming, the timing, and the automatic aspect of different types of willed movement. It's also very important for the ability to both start a movement and then to suppress that movement once that movement is started. Next slide, please.
Sure, Doctor. Please explain the significance of this slide.
That thing that looks like a little brain under your brain is called the cerebellum, And that's the kind of the, that is essentially the motor gyroscope of your brain. When you do any kind of skilled ballistic movement, the court reporter typing on her machine, you typing on a keypad, throwing a ball, playing a sport, when you're coordinating those skeletal muscles, the muscles that move your body, what enables you to execute the exact movement you wish to execute and not something else is due to your cerebellum. Interestingly enough, the very familiar roadside sobriety test, in which you're asked to do various different tasks that are indicate coordination. Essentially, what they're assessing is your cerebellum. The cerebellum is a very complex structure and is very susceptible to disruption by a variety of factors, and chemical intoxication is one of them. So, ironically enough, when you voluntarily suppress cerebellar functioning, this can produce the very symptoms that we see on a roadside test, which is incoordination and so on. Next slide, please.
Okay, doctor, and moving on to the next slide.
So remember, the thing about the brain is when we say this particular structure does this and that particular structure does that, what's important to understand is all of these parts of the brain, all of these systems, are operating in tandem. They're coordinated on a moment-to-moment basis. When you want to execute any kind of movement, first you've got to determine what that movement is. I want to play an instrument. I want to drive my car somewhere. I want to fire a weapon. Then the particular kinds of motions that go into that movement, putting the key in the ignition, raising the weapon, picking the guitar up, these are programmed by another part of the brain called the premotor area. And finally, the exact sequence of muscle movements necessary to carry out that particular activity, playing a certain chord on the instrument, actually turning the wheel, or pulling the trigger of a firearm. These are programmed by the primary motor cortex that's illustrated in pink, all the while being reinforced and influenced by those cerebellum and basal ganglia structures in a kind of loop feedback way to make what seems like simple behavior actually a very complex process that you don't really see the complexity of until something disrupts it in some way. Next slide, please.
Okay, doctor, we've talked a lot about the various parts of the brain and the significance of each part of those brain. My question is now, how does it relate to the various stages of memory?
Well, as I alluded to before, we tend to think of certain functions as being all of a piece, as one unitary function, but memory consists of many different types, and I'm not going to get into all of the different types, but one important distinction is between memory for how to do something and memory that we have done something, what's sometimes called procedural memory, memory for a skill. You know, we sometimes say that you can never forget how to ride a bike. That's because that's an example of that motor memory that you learned as a child, and decades can go by and you get back on that bike and with a few minutes practice, you're doing it again. That has been stamped into your brain largely through the basal ganglia system, and you may not remember exactly when you first learned to ride a bike. So memory for events, memory for things that happened to you, like what happened when you learned to ride a bike, or what happened in a deadly force encounter, these sometimes may not correspond to actually taking the necessary steps involved in that particular encounter. So memory first has to have an input part, and we mentioned that. If you're not paying attention to something, then you're not going to learn it. You know, if you're in school and you're thinking about something else while the teacher is giving an instruction, and later you're unable to remember that information on an exam, well, you didn't forget it. You didn't learn it in the first place. But assuming you paid attention, the memory has gotten into your brain, it then must be consolidated by that structure we call the hippocampus, so it can be stored in your brain. And this is very important. When memory is stored in your brain, it's not simply like putting something in a file folder and sticking it in a cabinet, because every time you encounter and learn something new that's related to information that's already in your brain undergoes a process of relearning. In other words, without you being consciously aware of it, you are constantly rehearsing, relearning, reinforcing information based on new information that's coming up. And that's why, for example, people who suffer memory damage, either through a traumatic accident or through dementia and old age, will often lose memory of things that happened most recently. They'll recall things that may have happened decades ago, even though they haven't thought of it, but they can't remember what they had for breakfast that morning. And that's because the information that has been there the longest hasn't just sat there, but is being reworked, reinforced every time something new comes in that reinforces it.
Okay. So that's... Doctor, if we can get, we'll get a little bit more specific here now. This is talking about the mindset in a deadly force situation.
Right. Let me just wait. One more statement about memory.
All right. Ask a question, Mr. Herbert.
Do you want me to go back to the previous slide?
Please go back to the previous slide just for a moment.
Sure.
Because the point is, all of the consolidation of storage doesn't do you much good if you can't retrieve it. And that's the other element. If that memory is in there, sometimes there may be problems retrieving even a memory that has already been stored. So when somebody reports a problem of memory, one of the things as clinicians, one of the things that psychologists who study the brain have to ask is, do you mean the memory wasn't perceived in the first place, it wasn't consolidated, it wasn't stored, or you can't recall it? Next slide, please.
Sure. And doctor, please talk about this slide as well.
All right, so again, this is what I mentioned in the beginning. These are the types of perceptual and cognitive distortions that have been reported for decades in just about anyone who goes through a very traumatic or stressful experience. It may be someone who is the victim of an assault. It may be someone who narrowly escapes death in a traffic accident. It may be someone who is involved in a plane crash or a tsunami or anything where there has been a life and death circumstance that the person has had to extricate themselves from. What we're applying it in this case to is the area in police psychology that's known as critical incident stress. A critical incident is any life and death emergency. It may include an officer-involved shooting, or it may include other types of life-threatening incidents. So what I'm about to tell you was not developed to explain simply what happens with police officers, but what happens to any of us if we're involved in a life-threatening encounter. And this has been studied in general in emergency psychology for decades. It's been studied more specifically in individuals who are first responders like police officers. So where does this data come from? It comes from observations and reports of police officers who have been in officer-involved shootings and other deadly force encounters who in the course of their clinical interviews have mentioned these phenomena. Now, in the vast majority of these cases, these are uncontested use of force incidents. It's not that they're being questioned or doubted in any action they took. These are typically officers that we will evaluate and others of my colleagues have evaluated in the course of a routine critical incident follow-up. And in fact, many of these phenomena are reported reluctantly because they seem strange to the person who's experienced them, and officers often wonder if there's something wrong with them. But because they are reported so commonly, not every officer, but many of them, so commonly, and they do have a certain consistency, you get the same types of reports, people have begun to study this systematically. So there are a variety of researchers around the country, William Lewinsky, Alexis Artwall, who have studied this and published studies on these types of phenomena. So my data points, what I'm about to testify to, come from a review of the literature, the peer-reviewed literature on the psychology of deadly force encounters, and also from my own experience in finding the same types of phenomena in many of the officers that I, myself, and my colleagues have evaluated. And what we've found is you get a variety of sort of universal experiences that happen. Not every police officer or other first responder is going to show all of these, but many of them will show at least a few. And the first is distortions in time perception. And once again, if you've ever been in a fraught circumstance yourself, see if this is something that may have happened in an emergency you've been in. A lot of times the report will be that things seem to have taken a lot shorter than they actually were, what's called time compression. It seemed like it was over in a couple of seconds, but really it took 15 minutes. In a smaller number of cases, this can go in the other direction. An officer may report that things seem to take longer than they actually took. It took 15 minutes, but it seemed like an hour. But again, what's happening here is that the memory for exactly what is taking place is not exactly what is the brain's priority at that point. These phenomena all are accounted for by the fact that in an emergency situation, it's something's bad, you got to do something, you've got to escape, but wait, you can't just escape, you have to neutralize the threat because that's your job. This, and that's essentially what explains what we're seeing on the slide.
Okay. Next slide.
We're still on this slide. Visual hyperfocus or tunnel vision. Now, tunnel vision is not something that happens just in emergency circumstances. In a sense, you're having tunnel vision in this courtroom because you're paying attention to my words and the images on your screen. You're not thinking about what the person next to you is wearing or the sound of the air conditioning until I point it out. But in an emergency situation, this becomes much more accentuated. You've got to focus in on exactly what that threat is. It's not uncommon for crime victims, for example, to report that they can't remember what their assailant looked like because they were too busy looking at the weapon. And so police officers will often experience this as well. They're focused in on the suspect. Things may have been going on in the periphery. People may have been talking to them. Things may have been happening. Cars are showing up, people in the periphery, and they will not recall that. Again, not because their memory is impaired. They weren't paying attention to that in the first place. Their brain was screaming, address the deadly threat. It doesn't really matter what these people on the side of you are saying, doing, or shouting.
All right, Doctor, how about any effects that it would have on auditory skills?
A very common phenomenon that, again, these are often baffling to the very people that are reporting them. They'll say, I do recall firing my weapon, but the gunshots seemed like pops. They seemed like faint. What the brain is actually doing is it's shutting out any type of, there are actually, without getting into details, there are actually neural mechanisms that can attenuate, that they can lessen the actual sound of something that you're hearing. And again, we've all had circumstances where you focus on something and somebody shouts something and you literally don't hear them until your attention is turned to what they're actually saying. So auditory exclusion, we can call tunnel hearing. And again, sometimes you get the opposite. Sometimes sounds will seem even louder than they're objectively judged to be. And you can get combinations of these reactions. So individuals will sometimes report that sounds may have been louder. They may have been focused in on things. They generally tend to go in the same direction. So someone who's going to report tunnel vision is probably going to report tunnel hearing. But you can get any combination of these. Most officers will report a few of them. Some report none at all. And a few of them will report a great number.
And, Doctor, how about the effect that deadly force has on cognitive and emotional distortions?
A report that I hear fairly common, and it's reported by my colleagues, is it's kind of like I went on automatic. It's kind of like I could see my gun hand sort of float up and draw down on the guy, and it's like my gun hand knew what to do. Now, of course, the hand didn't know what to do. What that officer is referencing is the fact that the motor memory was kicking in and wasn't relying on his frontal cortex to sit there and make a decision on what to do because there wasn't that luxury of time. And so it seems like, and you know, if you've ever been in a marathon or done something or had an exciting event and, you know, jogging or doing a performance on stage, and it almost as if your body takes over and knows what to do, that's a kind of dissociative experience. It's not dissociative in the sense of pathological or hallucinatory, but it's almost like your body knows what to do without you having to consciously program it. And in a sense, you kind of want to be able to do that. You don't want to have to think in an emergency situation, what do I do next? You want your body to respond automatically so you can use your brain power for any kind of new or novel circumstance that comes up. Much less commonly, officers will report that for a moment they froze or they felt a feeling of helplessness. But what another expert in police psychology, Dr. Artwall, has found out that when she interviews subjects who report this, it's not like they necessarily froze out of fear, but officers will often hesitate before using deadly force. Often deadly force is the last resort. It's not the default mode. And many officers will report that they withheld fire for a moment because they wanted to make sure that the threat was really a deadly threat. And so in their parlance, it's kind of like, I don't know why I froze, Doc. But they didn't freeze out of fear. They stopped the response because they did not want to fire unless they really felt there was something to fire at. Memory impairment, I think we've discussed. Memories can be misremembered. They can be memory gaps. And the reason for that is when you remember something, it's not like rewinding a videotape. Any kind of memory that you have is reconstructive. You're essentially pulling together the memory from the pieces that you remember. And for most purposes, and for most of us, that memory is accurate. But we've all had circumstances where we think we remember something one way, and then somebody points out a discrepancy, and we kind of chuckle because it was this name and not that name, or this person said this and it was not that person who said this. But the overall gist of the memory is intact. You know, some of the details may be different. I may have been standing on this side of the room versus that side of the room. And that's where for that difference between procedural memory, memory for a skill, and episodic memory, memory for exactly what took place, can become dissociated. So it's not uncommon for people in both normal circumstances and emergency circumstances to misremember certain details, even if they retain the overall gist of what that event was. Next slide, please.
Tell us about the significance of this slide.
All right. I mean, these are some studies that have been done, and I don't want to get into tremendous detail, but some of this has been studied experimentally. Shoot-don't-shoot experiments involve taking volunteers, often they're non-law enforcement college students, other times they involve police officers themselves, and they're presented with various scenarios, usually in the form of a briefly presented image, like a photograph, of a suspect holding a gun or holding a harmless object. It might be a power screwdriver or in some cases a tennis racket or a shoe. And what we find is, depending on the duration of exposure, those who elect to shoot, usually by pressing a button or not pressing it, or in some experiments by holding an actual facsimile of a gun. Many individuals, more so the naive college students, but even some experienced officers, will often fire quickly at a suspect holding a weapon that turns out not to be a weapon. It might be a power screwdriver, it might be a shoe. And the reason we do these studies is we want to point out that sometimes you can really believe that there is a deadly force situation that requires that level of force. Why would someone believe that? You know, we're talking about these reactions as if they occur in isolation. But in a typical law enforcement deadly force encounter, there's a context, there's a background. If, for example, there's been information that you have a suspect that appears particularly dangerous, if they're not behaving the way a suspect would ordinarily behave, you know, most police officers know that if you draw a weapon on someone and tell them to freeze or get on the ground or drop the weapon, a person is not stupid, they don't want to be killed, they're probably going to obey. If they don't, if they resist, they might have a mental illness, there might be a substance intoxication, and that makes that subject all the more unpredictable. And unpredictability in a tense situation usually means dangerousness. So the threat level, the heightened perception of a possible threat is going to be magnified when you have someone who has A, already shown a inclination to do something that most of us would never do, which is attack a police officer, especially a group of police officers who is overwhelming by numbers, is not obeying normal law enforcement commands to do what the officer is telling them to do. And there may be other circumstances as well. There might have been similar circumstances that occur. There might have been news reports describing a certain type of crime. All of this is percolating in that person's mind as they're trying to make that decision.
Okay, Doctor, tell us about some of the tipping points in deadly force encounters.
You know, one of the things I think I mentioned I do is training in verbal de-escalation strategies. If you look at a lot of the use of force incidents, whether or not they result in a fatality, what you'll often see is a combination of vicious cycles and tipping points. An officer encounters a citizen. There are some words exchanged. Something may happen. The citizen does something that causes the officer to perceive that that citizen is dangerous. The police officer does something to cause that citizen to feel they're being abused or disrespected. At some point, somebody touches somebody else. The next thing you know, there's a scuffle. It usually will lead to an arrest, but in some cases, tragically, it may lead to a deadly force encounter. And that's because at some point, there was a tipping point that went beyond simply an encounter, but into something that, in the minds of the individuals involved, required a use of deadly force.
Okay, Doctor, turning to your last slide, Liz. Please describe the significance of that.
Well, this sort of summarizes what we do in what's called a critical incident follow-up. Several days following an officer-involved shooting, after they've been administratively cleared, which is the overwhelming majority of cases, then, I mean, not all departments do this. This is actually a recommendation of the International Association of Chiefs of Police that all departments have this measure, but not every department does. They're sent to a psychologist just to basically see if they're mentally able to return to duty. This is because most people, you know, if you watch TV and movies, you assume that police officers fire their weapons and then they just walk away as if nothing happened. But firing a weapon, and especially if it does result in the fatality of a citizen, is a fairly profound event. You know, most people, police officers or even soldiers for that matter, they don't necessarily enjoy taking a human life, and they may have a psychological reaction to it. And these usually occur in the first 24 to 72 hours. Right after the event happens, there's going to be what they refer to as an adrenaline dump, which is really a state of physiological hyperarousal. That autonomic nervous system we talked about, that adrenaline we talked about, remains on overdrive for several hours. Once again, not just police officers. If you've been involved in a near-fatal car crash, if you've been involved in any kind of emergency, your nervous system doesn't just go back to baseline the moment the emergency is over. But after about several hours or a day or so, this typically abates, but that doesn't mean that their mind is turned off. Typically, sleep is impaired. There's obsessive rumination. They can't stop thinking about the event. Essentially, what they're doing when they describe it to me is kind of chewing it over and over and over in their brain. And what they're usually asking themselves is, what could have gone differently? Many police officers will obsessively second-guess themselves. What were the vicious cycles that led to this? What was the tipping point that might have been avoided? And the other thing they're trying to do in many cases is actually recall some of that information that was lost because they weren't processing it in the first place. And, you know, one of the things that we try to do in these evaluations is actually educate officers to the point that what they're experiencing represents a normal abnormality, that these are the kinds of perceptual and thinking disturbances that occur in any kind of emergency circumstance. So there's nothing bizarre or weak or unusual about them going through some of them. They'll often come home from a call and, you know, realizing how a person's life can change in a fraction of a second, there'll be an increased concern for their family. A lot of the cops will come home and say, you know, I went over and I kissed my kids and they basically chased me out of their room, but I had to do it because I knew that bad things can happen to people. A lot of times they don't want to talk about it. Well-meaningly, family members or friends will say, do you want to say what happened? And their kind of attitude is, well, I just lived through it. Give me a couple of days and let me just sort of work it off. And again, a lot depends on, a lot of the officer's eventual adjustment and reaction to a shooting depends on the action of others. If it's been administratively cleared, if it's not been a contested shooting, typically the officer returns to work within a week or so. If there's been a complication, it's been a particularly difficult shooting situation, there has been some administrative internal investigation, there is a lot of public outcry, there is legal action or internal investigations, and of course the adjustment process is going to be much more prolonged.
Okay, Doc, thank you. John, if I could avoid it. Okay, Doctor, kind of wrapping up here. All of these slides that we just went through, where they talked about the brain and the different parts of the brain and how it's affected, was that part of your methodology in rendering an opinion in this case?
Well, I drew upon that body of knowledge in rendering my opinion, yes.
And you also testified that you read reports from this incident, correct?
That's correct.
And you conducted an evaluation of my client, is that correct?
Right. I mean, most of the information that I based my conclusion on did come from my interview of your client.
And, Doctor, based upon your evaluation, did you render any opinions in this case?
Yes, I did.
Would you please tell the ladies and gentlemen of the jury what opinions you came to?
Do you want me to reference this particular case?
Yes.
Well, if we're talking about the officer in question, Jason Van Dyke, based on my analysis of everything that has been available to me at the time of the shooting on 10/20/14, Officer Van Dyke had received a call of an individual who had attacked a police car, punctured tires, and was refusing to respond to directions to drop a weapon. Ironically,
I'm sorry, Doctor, do you have an opinion?
Do you want me to go straight to my
opinion? I want you to give your opinion. That was the question. You want the question read back?
Thank you.
We understand that what you relied upon to make your opinion. I guess if you can just cut to the chase there and give us any opinions that you arrived at.
My opinion is that on 10-2014, Officer Jason Van Dyke responded to what he perceived was a deadly threat and responded in a way that, based on his training, was designed to neutralize that threat as he understood it.
And would your opinion be that his response was based upon a reasonable officer's response in the same situation?
A reasonable officer faced with the perceptual reality of what that officer, of what Officer Van Dyke was experiencing, the answer would be yes.
Okay. I have no further questions.
What we're going to do, ladies and gentlemen, we're just going to take about a 10-minute break, and then we'll resume with the cross-examination of the doctor.
All right, for the jury.
So the defense, as they're taking a break now in the courtroom, the defense clearly has just presented their expert on psychology of police and police psychology of use of force. And at the end, they're giving his opinion that after evaluating Officer Van Dyke in terms of the deadly shooting of Laquan McDonald 4 years ago, that on that particular night of October 20th, 2014, he stated along the lines of, my opinion is that Officer Jason Van Dyke responded to what he perceived as a deadly threat and responded to it based on his training to neutralize that threat, meaning go ahead and shoot, and then it goes into automatic response and it goes so quickly. But is that a defense against first-degree murder, or are there holes here that the prosecution under cross is going to be able to tear this apart? What do you think, Gall?
Well, first, I think that it was a very strong ending for this pretty long direct examination. There was a lot of legal and medical information there, a lot of information that some people can process and some people are...
Meaning the jurors. Are they all processing this step by step, or is some of it like, whatever, he shouldn't have fired, or he should have, he was right in the first, you know, because people have an opinion.
Correct. And so he went, and the slides, I think, were very good, that there were very good demonstrative exhibits, because you can see it, you can read it, and you can understand about the brain, about the process of the police officer at the time. And then he ended on a high note as to the reasons why. Now, the jurors, if the defense did its job right, the jurors are now going to draw back to their memories from earlier last week and earlier this week and say, okay, so what did Van Dyke know when he arrived to the scene? The doctors
got it in. And I had a question for you about that, for legal strategy, okay? Because the doctor, when he was asked for his opinion, started to say, well, my opinion, at the time of the shooting, I believe that Jason Van Dyke, what was on his mind, he had heard the call of an individual, the police radio scanner heard a call of an individual who had attacked a police squad car, slashed the tires, and wasn't responding to orders to drop the knife. So he's saying all this, and the judge and everything stopped him and said, hey, what is your opinion, though, after was he, did the defense perhaps coach him to voice it that way so that we can get that in for the jury one more time? This is what was on the officer's mind when he was arriving at the scene?
Well, I don't think the defense needs to coach an expert witness. An expert witness, part of their job is to provide testimony like that. I think the officer or the witness, the doctor, very genuinely wanted to explain what he
drew that opinion. Conclusion.
I'm not sure why the defense did not ask him, what did you base that opinion on, to see if the judge would let it in. The judge could have said, you went too far, stop here, or the judge would have let him give that reasoning of what he is basing that opinion on.
Meaning the radio chatter and what was coming up and what's in your mind, and then starting going into the training. The science tells us that once you're under that stress, you're heading... as what he said, explained, was that human beings in general, we're all sort of programmed to danger, get away. our first responders have to override that somehow and go toward the danger. Right. So he would probably get into those various things, but maybe the judge would have said, we've already explained all of that, but I think the defense would like to try it, tie it together for the jurors more so.
Correct. They want to hone it in and bring it to this specific particular situation. Because as the doctor said at the very beginning, the crux of this whole case is, what was the police officer, what was Van Dyke's perspective at the encounter? What did he have in his mind? What was he trained to do? And how did he react during that particular moment when, as the doctor says, he had that tunnel vision and time slowing,
which he said many officers have, and he evaluated Van Dyke. But he also said early on, and I'm wondering, because when we come back at some point here, the prosecution will get to cross-examine
right.
this expert, and something he had said early on was that there's no actual test, psychology test, that they can give to figure out what's all, they just know from science what the brain is doing and so on. They have to rely on what the officer tells them. So if the prosecution is going to say you've made these opinions based on what the officer told you or didn't tell you, how do you know it's accurate? How do you know what he's not trying to cover, you know, trying to make it sound better for himself? I mean, there are all those sort of scenarios.
Right. So if the prosecution did its homework on memory and psychology, they should be able to at least have some sort of a effective cross-examination, because Van Dyke was, I'm assuming, interviewed by this doctor not too long ago, which is long after the events happened.
Interesting.
And so when you have such a long time in between the event and the interview, your memory, if you learn psychology and you learn about memory, and it goes to eyewitness eyewitness identification as well, when you see something at the moment, as the doctor explained, your brain goes into, there's a lot of moving parts in your brain.
So you might retain part of it, but then there could be gaps because you were so focused on whatever the threat.
Right, and those gaps are filled in
later
on by not true memories and true events.
By sort of stories that you kind of your brain wants to manufacture.
Correct. And so when you cross-examine, for example, an eyewitness to an event, that's what you focus on, because the events are shocking. The events happen in moments, especially if you are a police officer who, as the doctor said, time slows down. You don't really store it in your memory. You don't have everything in your memory. You're just reacting the way that you have learned to react. And so when this doctor has questioned or talked to or evaluated Van Dyke about the events, mm-hmm. how much of those events are real memories from the event itself, and how much of those memories are things that Van Dyke has pieced together and created that memory in his brain later on.
And that's not just saying that anybody does that viciously, because we've, in the Hydea Pendleton trial, we heard from a memory expert who said that those pieces, innocently enough, can come in because you hear somebody else say something and it's kind of there, you later read something, and now your brain starts putting time to keep it as a story, because that's what our brain wants to do, any of us.
Correct. And that's what, if the prosecution really learned how to cross-examine this expert, that's what they should do. They should go back and say, okay, so you interviewed Van Dyke, but you interviewed him so much later after the events, and all this has happened in between, and then talk to this officer about the perspective of Van Dyke with those gaps in memory, and also talk to him about the way that he explained that you kind of go into an automatic mode as mm-hmm. a police officer. So he described and said some officers do freeze, what he called freeze, but
it's not
really...
They froze, but they really didn't just freeze. They took time to reevaluate.
Correct. So why wasn't there a reevaluation? So Van Dyke arrives to the scene with information, but he is in the car with his partner, mm-hmm. who has the exact same information, yet the partner quote-unquote freezes, and Van Tuyck doesn't. So the partner tried to, during his direct examination with the prosecution, to maybe be more or give testimony that was more favorable to Van Tuyck.
Oh, he certainly did. He was a prosecution witness, but everybody thought he really helped the defense more than the prosecution, if you're to believe him, because he basically stated that from their angle, they perceived a threat. Well, why didn't the partner shoot? Because right. he felt Van Tuyck had them both covered. It wasn't necessary for both to shoot.
Right, but he didn't really take any steps towards even thinking about shooting. And that's, and I'm not sure why the prosecution called that witness.
Yeah, because they didn't really then tear it apart in any way. It was very odd at the beginning of the trial.
Right, and it was not a very well-placed witness and not a very smart legal decision to call that witness in the first place. I thought maybe the prosecution thought that they were safer calling him because he did get immunity, but it backfired on them.
Well, the prosecution now, as you say, I would be highly surprised if they haven't studied all kinds of memory and this and that. And what you're saying is interesting, that if this doctor just more recently interviewed Jason Van Tuyck, then it's like a whole other ball game than if we'd had an initial interview with him almost right after. And there's just so much about what happened right after, which has led to the controversy surrounding this case, because so many officers have basically justified what had happened. The reports were all sort of written that way. And at first, there were no charges against Officer Van Tuyck. But as things kind of moved on and there was some kind of fishy points and somehow somebody got wind that there was police dash cam, now journalists get involved and it's a year later we see that video, it's highly incriminating when you see that police dash cam video, at least it seems to be, so it benefits the prosecution, as I said early on. But the defense is trying to say that from the officer's perspective, it was just very different. And they have had witnesses trying to show that, from the a video recreation and also the partner testifying in the past about, the pressure they were under and what they perceived. And so really, I just feel that as much as so many of us have had an opinion along the way, the officers involved, they have a tough job. And the jurors in this case are going to have an extremely difficult time trying to figure out, taking into account this 3D video recreation that the defense put on, and counter that next to the police dash cam video that you see from the other angle, from behind Laquan McDonald, where it looks like he's walking away from police, where in this one he's closing the distance a bit. But why did the officer keep shooting? There are just so many things. I don't know how the jurors will really be able to, they just really need to put any kind of personal feeling aside to make an intellectual decision based on what the judge said the law is in terms of first degree murder. But golf, is that humanly possible to put it all aside?
That's unfortunately for these jurors, that's their job. Their job is to focus on what was presented to them and from both sides and make the legal, not the legal determination first, but factual determinations first, and then follow the law with what the judge is telling them. They're looking at things that are that have two completely opposite points of view. The prosecution point of view is that Van Tuyck did not act reasonably and did not act in a way that it was necessary for him to act at that time. Mm-hmm. And the defense is doing a very good job to show their point of view. They have brought on quite a few witnesses that are telling the jury Van Tuyck did act reasonably. And now this last witness that we heard kind of put it all together in a way to explain why it is reasonable for Van Tuyck at the moment to act the way he was acting.
Because past testimony, we had some officers testifying that their view of Laquan McDonald, the way he was acting, he was seemed deranged, or he sort of unfazed by all this activity around him and not listening. But then other officers had testified in terms of the prosecution, saying that they did not feel a personal threat. But yet, so they were waiting for a taser to arrive. But Officer Van Tuyck suddenly arrives unseen, as we saw in the video recreation. His squad car with Walsh, his partner inside, they seem to cut off Laquan McDonald because they think he's going to go into a Burger King. They cut him off and veer out in the street, cutting him off again before a Dunkin' Donuts, and then Van Tuyck jumps out and shoots. Hard cut time there. So let's listen as they continue now here in court.
Yes.
And one is the clinical psychologist, right?
Yes.
In that role, so you are treating somebody, correct?
Well, evaluating and or treating, yes.
Okay. And then you have the forensic role. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, in this case, your role is you are hired by the defendant to testify in this case. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And how much are you being paid for your assistance of the defense?
My fee for the initial evaluation was $10,000. My fee for testimony is $10,000 per day.
$10,000 a day?
That's correct.
Okay. And you, during the evaluation, you indicated your opinion is based on information that you were provided by the defense attorney. Is that correct?
Yes.
And you said, and only on information provided by the defense attorney. Is that correct?
By the defense attorney, yes.
And the most...
Well, let me correct that, please. Obviously, information provided by the defendant himself.
The defendant himself, indeed. So, in fact, you testified that the most important tool you had in rendering your opinion was the statements the defendant made to you himself, correct?
That's correct.
Because you did talk to the defendant, is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, normally in your practice, when you're involved in a clinical work with a client, you're going to be sitting alone in a room with him. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And you're going to meet with him privately, because you and he can have a frank and open discussion, correct?
That's right.
But that's not what you did in this case, is it?
No, it's not.
Because in this case, what you did was you had a conversation with the defendant over Skype. Is that correct?
Yes.
So that's not an ideal way to have meaningful communication, is it?
Not ideal, but acceptable.
Okay. Now, and it wasn't just you and the defendant involved in this Skype conversation, was it?
Yes, it was.
Well, who else was present in the room in the defendant's room, during this Skype communication?
Actually, Mr. Herbert and his associate were in my office during the time I was interviewing Jason Van Dyke as observers.
So Mr. Herbert, the defendant's attorney, was present during this Skype interview that you did with the defendant, correct?
That's right.
Okay. Now, I believe you testified that there's no psychometric test to measure that you can use to measure how much you can rely on what a police officer is telling you. Is that right?
Well, that's not what I said. Well, maybe I didn't make myself clear. There's no psychometric test that can assess what is going through a police officer's mind during a deadly force encounter. So,
okay. All right, thank you. So, there's no test to assess what is really going on through the officer's mind. Is that correct?
Well, there's really no test to assess what's going through anyone's mind. What I meant by lack of a psychometric test was, if I'm assessing someone for an organic brain syndrome, there are certain standardized tests of memory, intelligence, and so on. If I'm assessing someone for the presence of a mood disorder or schizophrenia, there are certain personality tests that are standardized that we administer. In a case like this, there really are no psychometric tests that I needed to formulate my opinion.
So there were no psychometric tests to tell you whether or not the defendant was telling you what really happened. Is that correct?
That statement is correct.
And you didn't perform any, because there are psychological tests to talk about that help determine whether a person is malingering or that type of thing, correct?
There are tests that are sensitive to malingering when one is trying to portray oneself as impaired in some way, as less intelligent, as more impaired in memory, but subjective impairment wasn't an issue in this particular case.
And you didn't perform any psychological tests on the defense, is that correct?
I think I just said that.
And there's a wide variety, a range of psychological tests that psychologists employ. Is that correct?
Do you mean for in general or for
yes.
This particular case? There are literally thousands of tests.
Okay. And of those thousands, you used zero. Correct. Correct?
Correct.
Okay. Now, you talked about how emotion and memory are related. Is that correct?
Yes, they are.
And there's a whole range of emotions that we experience. Is that correct?
There are some fundamental emotions, but yes, they can have varying degrees of intensity and severity.
And one of those emotions is fear, right?
Yes.
Another emotion is anger, correct?
That's correct.
Another emotion is frustration. Is that correct?
Well, I don't know if you call it an emotion, but yes, people do become frustrated.
And that, of course, affects how people behave. Is that correct?
Yes, it does.
And you talked about how people often respond emotionally in emergency situations. Is that right?
Yes.
And it's also true, of course, that people respond emotionally in non-emergency situations. Is that correct?
Most people respond emotionally to most situations.
And that emotional response can significantly affect their behavior. Is that correct?
Yes.
And in fact, impatience can control a person's behavior. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, what was that term?
Impatience.
It can influence a person's behavior, certainly.
Because people do things that they regret, oftentimes, correct?
We all do.
And that can be out of frustration. Is that correct?
So far, everything is correct, yes.
That can be out of impatience. Is that correct?
Yes.
That can be just a momentary loss of self-control. Is that correct?
In some cases, that is correct.
That can be... You testified that, in police-citizen encounters, sometimes the police officer encounters a subject who feels disrespected by the police. Is that correct?
Commonly, yes.
And commonly, sometimes when that person feels disrespected by the police, that person engages in violence. Is that correct?
They may.
He lashes out. Is that correct?
They could.
Now, a police officer can also feel disrespected by a subject on the street. Is that correct?
They frequently do.
And the officer can then lash out violently when he feels disrespected. Can't.
It's possible, but that's one of the things they're specifically trained to monitor and control.
And they're trained to control their behavior, but sometimes humans don't control their behavior. Is that correct?
True for all of us.
And police officers are trained to suppress behavior when it's necessary to suppress. Is that correct?
Yes.
And the brain allows us to suppress our behavior and think flexibly and change as the situation changes. Is that correct?
In fact, that's what I testified to earlier.
And that ability to change our behavior can be affected by these emotions. Is that correct?
That is one of the things that can affect the ability to change a course of behavior.
About in that memory can be imperfect habits, correct?
Yes.
And so what we see and what we experience and what we talk about can be different because we made a mistake. Is that correct?
Not sure what you mean by that question. Could you please rephrase it?
Well, you testified that there's all kinds of things that impair a person's ability to relate accurately what he experienced. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, but there's one important phenomenon that deals with people relating things inaccurately, which is that lying. Is that correct?
Did you say lying?
Lying.
Yes, people can lie.
People can lie and people do lie. Is that correct?
They sometimes do.
And sometimes people lie to try to make themselves look better. Is that correct?
I think we all do that sometimes.
And we all sometimes try to describe our behavior in a manner that makes us look more justified. Is that correct?
That's true.
So that is one of the phenomena that could have affected the validity or the truth of what the defendant told you when he described what happened. Is that correct?
It potentially could.
about how life-threatening situations can impact on our ability to remember things. Is that right?
Yes.
And so, in order for, because that causes adrenaline to rush and this tunnel vision and all these other phenomena, correct?
Yes.
So, if a person is in a real fear for his life, these brain mechanisms you talk about kick in, is that correct?
In emergency circumstances, they do, yes.
But the emergency has to be real, doesn't it? As opposed to made up story afterwards.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the entire question.
Well, isn't your analysis based on the idea that it really was an emergency, that the person really was terrified?
Actually, my analysis is based on that the emergency was perceived to be by an emergency, to be an emergency by that person in question.
But if the person doesn't actually perceive it to be an emergency, then these reactions are not going to come into play. Is that correct?
Well, you're bringing up a very important point, and if
that
I could...
It's a simple yes or no
Judge,
question.
Judge, I let me answer this question. You might not be answered. He wants to answer.
Overrule Dr. Answer's question, please.
Please repeat the question.
If the emergency isn't real... Let me go back. If I walk up to you and go, boo! Now, you might be terrified, is that correct?
Yes.
But, and you might say you're terrified, correct?
Yes.
Or, and if you said you're terrified, you might be lying about that. You might be making up because that's maybe not that terrifying at all, right?
Well, if I'm restricted to yes and no, of course the answer has to be yes. It's possible.
And if it's just a person coming up and saying boo, that if that's an experience, if you're not terrified by it, then all these brain reactions that you talked about don't come into play, do they?
They may not.
Well, they may not or they don't.
Judge, I reject the relevance. What is the relevance of somebody coming up and saying boo to somebody? What's that effect there?
Overrule. Go ahead.
Again, being restricted to a binary answer of yes and no, the answer is that it's possible that what they are reporting, no, is not what in fact took place.
Okay. Now, you testified that, in your opinion, the defendant responded to a perceived threat. Is that correct?
Yes.
And you base that largely on what the defendant told you. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, at what point did the defendant perceive this threat, this life-threatening emergency?
As it was related to me, this was something that emerged and built up over time. The threat was first perceived when the officer got the report of an individual attacking police cars and puncturing tires. I'm trying to answer your question.
Let him answer the question.
The threat was further heightened by the officer's perception that the suspect did not drop the weapon when ordered to do so. It was then heightened further by him actually encountering the subject and the subject staring at him with an atypical facial expression indicating some level of cognitive impairment to that officer. And then further heightened by the fact that even when the officer responded to the deadly threat in a way that he perceived would neutralize it, perceived the suspect to still be threatening and therefore to continue to pose a deadly threat. So this was something that built up over time, each successive event, again, that vicious cycle, building up to the circumstances that we now know about.
Okay. Now, you talked about the defendant. The defendant considers him to be a man, himself to be a man of action. Is that correct?
I'm not sure what you mean by that question.
Well, did he tell you that... Did he say to you, I'm an active person, when you talked to him about himself?
He said he was an active person. That's what he told me, yes.
Okay. Now, he also told you that... Because he told you that he did, in fact, hear some radio communication by other officers. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, did he tell you that he heard the word attack?
The word what?
Attack.
Yes.
Because, I mean, you testified that you looked at the reports and the officer never said his vehicle was attacked, correct?
The officer in question did not say that his personal vehicle was attacked. That's correct.
Well, he said he popped our tires, correct?
Yes.
So, at that time, Jason Van Dyke was some distance away from Fort Hicks and Pulaski. Is that correct?
When he heard that, yes.
And when he heard that, he looked over to, he told you, that he looked over to his partner, Joe Walsh, and said...
All right, excuse me, Mr. Cullum. We're going to have to break right now. Take the jury back, please.
All right, for the jury.
So in the middle of prosecution, cross-examination of the defense expert psychologist on police psychology when it comes to the use of deadly force, suddenly we have to take a break. Why would that happen? Did the judge find some sort of flaw with the prosecution's questioning? Is or the judge maybe got some information that we don't know about?
Maybe a bathroom break or technical difficulties in the courtroom. I didn't hear an objection, so it's not a sidebar.
Yeah, because all of a sudden it was just that we're taking a break.
Yeah. I heard the judge talk to somebody on the side. So either he was talking to a deputy or a clerk and something came up and he needed to get off the bench for something. I don't think it relates to the trial.
I guess we may or may not find out. But right now, as we're waiting that one out, how do you feel about the prosecution going after this witness now? Are they making...
Otherwise, yes.
Actually, we're going to go back out to the courtroom. Let's just take a look.
Room order?
No, I didn't know.
You didn't know. Who is sitting next to you? Who's that? Get that individual up here. Before I ask him if he was sitting next to you when the decorum order was read, I want you to think about your answer. All right? Did you see here my deputy read the decorum order in this courtroom?
Yes.
All right. Thank you for coming up. All right. Take him into custody. I find you in direct contempt of court. Gentlemen, especially members of the press, we have an extended media coverage here where we have a pool camera and also the audio is pooled so that all the members of the press get equal access to this. Trying to game the system, trying to get ahead and put yourself in front of justice isn't tolerable in this courtroom. So, all right, bring our wonderful people back up.
All right, for the jury.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it sounds like a reporter there in the courtroom wasn't following the judge's order in terms of, it sounds like from the little bit we got that he might have been somehow recording testimony on his phone, possibly to help himself out with later writing up what he needed to do or presenting, but very expressly forbidden by the judge in the decorum order in terms of how this trial can be covered. I mean, we're fortunate to be able to bring it to you live, but we also have to follow very strict rules in terms of what we're doing here, so that reporter was made an example of, and other reporters saw it happening, so it was going to be, I'm sure, on best behavior. But they're now bringing back the witness about the psychologist. So is the prosecution making some points, do you think?
And you don't mess with Judge Gohan.
Yeah, so we've learned.
Yeah. I think they're making, they started by making some good points, and then they asked a very artful question about what is it that you based your opinion on, and he was able to bring out, the doctor was able to bring out what he wanted to bring out at the end of the defense questioning, and that is the reasons why he came to the conclusions that he came.
And so not just a yes or a no, there's just more to this evaluation.
When you ask an open-ended question, you're
basically doing that to yourself. Okay, let's listen as they continue.
Are you saying that the radio dispatch talks about an officer saying he stabbed the windshield?
I'm telling you what Jason Van Dyke told me.
Okay, all right. Okay, that's, thank you for clarifying. So he told you that he heard an officer go on the radio and say they stabbed the witch. Is that correct?
That two things that he heard on the radio that he related to me was that the subject had stabbed the windshield with a knife and had punctured tires.
Okay. And you only know what he told you. You don't know what the radio dispatch actually related. Is that correct?
In terms of formulating my report, that's what I used as the basis, was what Jason Van Dyke told me, yes.
So if he had said that he heard that the officer reported that a windshield be stabbed, then he would be exaggerating the threat that he was aware of. Is that correct?
Objection. Overrule.
Not that he would be exaggerating the threat, but that an officer hearing that police cars had already been attacked by a subject might have their threat level heightened by that information.
Correct. By the information, but only if he actually had that information, correct?
Yes.
And if he didn't have that information, because the radio transcript doesn't show it, then him saying that would be exaggerating the threat.
Objection.
My point.
Mistaken evidence.
Dr. Yemstead, a question.
Just so I give the proper answer, can you just repeat and clarify the question for me?
If he told you that the radio, that somebody said over the radio he stabbed the windshield, and no one actually said that, he would be exaggerating the threat level.
If he reported to me something that, in fact, he did not hear, then that would be an exaggeration, yes.
And if you could also call it a lie. Is that correct?
Excuse me. All right. Credibility is not determined by any witness, all right? Move on.
Now, but at the time when he heard, now he knew that the person had a knife and he stabbed the squad tire. He knew that that person was defying the authority of the police. Is that correct?
Yes.
And he knew that this person was defying the authority of one of his fellow officers. Is that correct?
Yes.
And that could cause emotion. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, it could cause what?
Emotion.
It might.
And in fact, when he heard that, he then looked over to his partner, or he told you that he looked over to his partner, Joe Walsh, and said, why didn't they shoot him if he's attacking them? Is that what he told you he said at that time?
Yes, it is.
Now, this was long before the defendant ever saw Laquan McDonald. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then he told you that when he was a block and a half away from the point where he actually shot McDonald, he said, oh, my God, we're going to have to shoot the guy. Is that correct?
That's what he told me.
Now, he also told you that when he first saw Laquan McDonald, he saw that Officer McGilligan and Officer Gaffney were both chasing Laquan McDonald. Is that correct?
Yes.
So he would have known that both the officers that he said were under attack were not harmed. Is that correct?
Just repeat that last part, please.
So he would have known that each of the officers he said were under attack were unharmed at that moment. Is that correct?
Yes, because they were still chasing.
They were chasing him. And so he was observing two officers chase Laquan McDonald. Is that correct?
Yes.
So he was watching Laquan McDonald engage in avoidance behavior, running away from the cops. Is that correct?
Those two officers, yes.
Well, those two officers, correct. And in fact, he would have known that Laquan McDonald had disabled a vehicle by stabbing its tire, making it easier to avoid the squad car that was chasing, correct?
Well, I don't know what Laquan McDonald was thinking, simply what Officer Van Dyke told me, which was he knew about the punctured tire.
So the only thing he knew about what he was thinking is, why don't they shoot the guy?
Well, that's not what he said.
He looked over to Joseph Walsh and said, why don't they shoot him if he's attacking them? Correct?
That is what he said. That is what he told me. He said.
And at that time, he knew that those officers had asked for a taser. Is that correct?
That's what he told me.
Now, when he saw the officers chasing Laquan McDonald, when he saw Laquan McDonald running from the police to the Burger King, he told you that he cut off Laquan McDonald in the Burger King lot. Is that correct?
That's what he told me, yes.
He told you that he was preventing Laquan McDonald from going into the Burger King. Is that correct?
He told me that was his intention.
But he didn't tell you that Laquan McDonald didn't make any move toward the Burger King door when he was running from the police, did he?
No, I don't recall him telling me that.
And in fact, he didn't tell you that actually he didn't cut off Laquan McDonald because Laquan McDonald passed the Burger King entrance before Jason Van Dyke passed the Burger King entrance. Isn't that correct?
I don't recall him telling me that. That's correct.
Then he saw Laquan McDonald. You said that he told you he was in fear of Laquan McDonald?
At some point he was, yes. That's what he told me.
And that was based on what McDonald was doing, which was demonstrating his threatening attitude toward police and to civilians?
Well, not simply an attitude. He related to me that Laquan McDonald made what Officer Van Dyke perceived as some threatening movements with a weapon.
Because he saw Laquan McDonald cut through the Burger King parking lot and not make any threatening movements towards Burger King, correct?
At that point, yes.
He had observed Laquan McDonald, or he had observed a person who was on the path of travel of Laquan McDonald pointing to the police officer in the direction he was running, correct?
Yes.
Running from the police, correct?
Yes.
A person who had not, there was no evidence that that person had suffered any aggression from the defendant, correct?
As far as can be ascertained, that's correct.
When he turned onto the street, he observed what he described as a kid matching the description of a caller. Is that correct?
Yes.
So he observed what he described as a kid, correct?
As I just said, yes.
And that kid, we later learned, was Laquan McDonald, correct?
That's correct.
He told you that Laquan McDonald, or kid, was running toward the Dunkin' Donuts. Is that correct?
Yes.
Did he tell you that he observed Laquan McDonald never cross the center line of Pulaski toward McDonald?
I don't have an independent recollection of what he stated on that point, but if I did document that in my report, then I agree that that's what he told me.
So any officer's perception or idea that Laquan McDonald was going to endanger people in Dunkin' Donuts would have been abated when Laquan McDonald veered away from Dunkin' Donuts. Would you agree with that?
Well, again, then now you're asking me to get inside the head of that officer. I can't really discuss what that officer might have thought. But in the benefit of hindsight, what you just said would appear to be the truth.
So it's only in hindsight that a person should conclude that a person walking away from Dunkin' Donuts is attacking Dunkin' Donuts?
Stated as stated, that would not be a reasonable conclusion.
Now, the defendant testified that he saw the defendant and...
I'm sorry, you're confusing. Look at what you just said.
Sorry, Your Honor.
Restate.
Yeah. Now, the defendant told you that when Laquan McDonald was 10 to 15 feet from him, he saw Laquan McDonald flip open a knife. Is that correct?
That's what he told me.
But you saw the video, and Laquan McDonald had actually flipped open the knife well before the defendant was within 10 to 15 feet of him. Isn't that correct?
That's what the video does seem to show.
And the video does seem to show that when Laquan McDonald flipped open the knife, he was right next to another squad car. Is that correct?
I would have to just stipulate on the correctness of that. I don't have an independent recollection of that particular scene.
And the defendant would be able, would have seen that when Laquan McDonald flipped open that knife near the vehicle, Laquan McDonald immediately began to veer in the direction toward a fence and away from that vehicle. Is that correct?
Objection. The defendant would have seen.
The same. Rephrase.
Well, did the defendant tell you that that's what he saw?
That's what the defendant told me, yes.
Well, he saw, because he told you that he saw Laquan McDonald flip open the knife when he was 10 to 15 feet away from the defendant, correct?
That's what he did tell me, yes.
And you would agree that if a person flipped open a knife 10 to 15 feet away from a person, that would be much more of a real threat than if someone had flipped open the knife a greater distance away.
I think a reasonable person would conclude that.
And he said that before shooting Laquan McDonald, he said, drop the knife, drop the knife. Is that correct?
Well, that wasn't an exact quote, but that's close enough.
And he said that Laquan McDonald did not drop the knife. Is that correct?
Yes.
And so Laquan McDonald, he was perceiving Laquan McDonald defying his authority. Is that correct?
That was the implication. Jason Van Dyke did not use those words, but that might have been the inference.
And the inference might be that Laquan McDonald didn't drop the knife, but he walked away from the defendant, snubbing his nose at the defendant's authority. Is that correct?
I don't know anything about his nose, but it does show him walking away.
Now, the defendant told you that Laquan McDonald brought the knife across his chest. Is that correct?
That is what Van Dyke said.
Now, did he tell you that he had actually immediately after this incident, he told Detective March that McDonald raised the knife across his chest and over his shoulder, pointing the knife at Van Dyke.
That's what Van Dyke told me he told that other officer, yes.
So he told the officer a version which was much more, which would be much more threatening than what he told you. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And again, when a person describes an incident, they may be mistaken or they may be intentionally trying to justify their behavior. Is that correct?
It could be either of those possibilities.
And you just have the defendant's word for what he said actually happened. Is that correct?
In terms of my interview, yes.
Now, you said that another supposedly threatening act that Laquan McDonald engaged in was he looked at the defendant in a threatening way?
In what way?
In some way that would trigger these adrenaline and responses?
Well, as Van Dyke specifically referred to it, he looked at him with a kind of dead stare.
So he looked at him, and in fact, in video which showed that the defendant only had about 33 seconds of actual contact with the defendant, with the Laquan McDonald. Is that correct?
I'll accept your assessment of the timing.
And then when he got out of the car, it was only 6 seconds before the defendant chose to pull the trigger the first time. Is that what the video shows?
That's what it does show.
And when did he see the dead's stare? Was it in the 6 seconds when he was out of the car before he shot? Or was it the 27 seconds when he was observing him while he was in the vehicle?
He did not specify.
But he was able to assess a dead stare, is that correct?
Well, that's what he told me he saw.
And in fact, he further analyzed this and said it was like looking into the quantum down's soul. Is that what he told you?
Those were his words.
And he did all of this in this very short period of time when he was focusing on, well, the fact that he claims the final balance reached the knife over his shoulder.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Well, when did he tell you he was making this assessment about the Laquan McDonald's soul?
Well, the words that he told me he said at that time were based on when he pulled up on the scene and emerged to confront McDonald.
Okay, when you say confront, you mean that he got out of his car and 6 seconds later fired a shot, correct?
Actually, let me rephrase, because I think we're using the term confront in a hostile way. Let's say when he first encountered McDonald.
When did he first encounter McDonald?
When he rolled up on the scene and observed him and then emerged from his vehicle.
But he had been watching Laquan McDonald engage in avoidance behavior leading up to that moment of confrontation, hadn't he?
He was engaged in watching Laquan McDonald engaging in the behavior that you just described. Whether he at the time characterized it as avoidance behavior, I can't know.
Now, he fired the shot at Laquan McDonald. You talk about the shooting was a voluntary act, pulling the trigger. Is that correct?
Say that again, please.
Well, the defendant chose to begin shooting at Laquan McDonald, didn't he?
Well, yes. We're assuming it was a self-initiated response.
But he didn't actually choose to stop shooting at Laquan McDonald, did he?
He did not stop shooting until what the record shows he fired.
Well, he didn't stop shooting until he ran out of bullets. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So really, he chose to stop shooting only in the sense that he chose to load his handgun with a magazine that only carried 15 rounds. Is that correct?
He stopped shooting when the magazine was exhausted.
And then he put another one in, correct?
That's right.
And then his partner said, "Jason, I've got this," correct?
Yes.
No further questions of this witness at this time, Your Honor.
Mr. Herbert, redirect.
Thank you.
Hello again, Doctor.
Hello. You were asked a lot of questions about statements that Jason Van Dyke made to you and how you relied on Jason Van Dyke's statements partially in preparing your evaluation, correct?
Yes.
Were you able to assess the veracity of Jason Van Dyke's statements in any way?
Well, that's a fair question asked by you and opposing counsel. And to answer that, one of the things that's extremely important as a forensic examiner is to assess for what we call malingering. Since the primary database in a psychological evaluation is what that person tells you, sometimes supported by what other people tell you, sometimes supported by witnesses, but the primary database is what that person is telling me. And you can't take an x-ray of a person's mind like you can x-ray a person's leg. You've got to kind of assess whether what they're telling you is true. So how do we do this? We look for consistency, and we look for it in two ways. And of course, to anticipate the obvious question, can anybody say with 100% certainty that somebody is 100% telling the truth? Of course not. When you go to your doctor and he says, how are you feeling? And you tell him about all of your health problems, but you forget the fact to tell him, or you conveniently forget to tell him that you're still smoking or that you haven't been taking your medication reliably. Sure, you're making some things up. How does the doctor know you're telling the truth? He doesn't. But he has to make that assessment of what he's going to do based on what you tell him. So in a psychological evaluation, we look for consistency two ways. We look for, is what this person telling me consistent with what we know about situations like this? If a person is claiming that they have schizophrenia and they're having auditory hallucinations, is this something that most patients with schizophrenia will experience? Yes. If they're saying that they're seeing little pink elephants, that's not a common symptom of schizophrenia. That raises an index of suspicion. It doesn't necessarily mean they're lying, but that makes it suspicious. We also look for consistency in what the person reports over time. Because when you have to make up something, when you have to actually invent something, it's a lot harder for your brain to do that than it is to simply recall something that actually happened. So there's a tendency when you tell the story over and over again, especially to multiple points in time, the story keeps changing because you kind of forget what version you gave each time you give it. So what we see in a case like this, in terms of what Van Dyke is telling this examiner, is the story coheres, it fits together in terms of what we know about the perceptual and cognitive phenomena that take place in an officer-involved shooting. It doesn't seem like there are any bizarre symptoms. It doesn't seem like he's trying to load excessive number of symptoms there. These kinds of distortions are things that we see in officers all the time in completely uncontested, contested types of situations, no investigations, no legal actions. So they're consistent in that respect. Secondly, the story that has been told over time. I don't know what Jason Van Dyke is going to say today, but essentially in terms of what he's told investigators, what he told his attorneys, and what he told me, seems to be the same thing that he's reporting from moment to moment. And if that's the case, I have to use my clinical inference that I would do with any clinical case or any forensic case to come up with a judgment and assessment that essentially Jason Van Dyke is telling the truth in this case as he understands that. Is he misremembering some things? Did he perceive some things 15 feet, 30 feet? These are consistent with the types of distortions that people have during any emergency situation. Again, many people in this room may have had the same phenomenon. But you don't make an assessment of malingering unless you have firm evidence to do so. Because if that were the truth, nobody, no clinician, no criminal investigator, no doctor could ever believe anything a person says. So it's a combination of looking for certain index signs and then using one's knowledge and expert judgment to come to a conclusion that with a reasonable degree of clinical certainty, the phenomena that are reported by Jason Van Dyke to have occurred during this incident are consistent with what we know are the cognitive and perceptual distortions during a critical incident, and that he seems to be reporting them in an accurate and honest way.
So he was telling you the truth.
Objection.
Sustained.
Put another way to what you just testified, you look for certain truth detectors.
Let the doctor testify now.
I believe that Jason Van Dyke told me the truth as he perceived that truth.
And as a doctor, you talk about your clinical evaluations. It's important for you to assess the patient's credibility, correct?
Yes, it is. I mean, if I believe that anyone I'm doing a forensic evaluation on is lying to me, I'm going to say that. I'm not going to stick my neck out and try to pretend something that's not.
And if you believe Jason Van Dyke was lying to you, you wouldn't be here testifying, correct?
That's correct.
You wouldn't have given the opinion that you provided the ladies and gentlemen the jury.
Well, I wouldn't have gotten that far. I would have simply told you that I don't think this is a credible case and moved on.
Okay. And you were asked some questions about Jason, told you that that the vehicle, he heard over the radio that the officers in the vehicle were being attacked by your profound doubt, right?
Yes.
By popping the tire and slashing the windshield, correct?
Yes.
In fact, there was a police officer in that car with the window down, you know that, correct?
That's right.
So that wasn't attacked, right?
Based on the information I have, if somebody is stabbing a vehicle with a weapon, that would be the definition of an attack.
Okay. And anything about that statement that Jason Van Dyke made, did that indicate to you in any way that Jason Van Dyke respect that? You would agree with me that that statement that Jason Van Dyke made, that would certainly be one of the factors that raised the threat level, as you talked about how this threat was rising throughout the incident, right?
Well, my interpretation of that is a person who is perceiving fellow officers being attacked and not understanding why they're not taking action to defend themselves.
Okay. Anything about that statement that Jason Van Dyke made, did anything about that indicate to you that Jason Van Dyke was out of control or acting different than any other reasonable police officer would have acted at that point?
Well, he was in fear, but I'm assuming that any reasonable police officer hearing that fellow officers were being attacked would be alert to a threat.
You were asked questions about how the prosecutor asked you that Jason Van Dyke told you that there was a kid matching that description, with a lot of emphasis on the word kid. Remember by the prosecutor?
Yes.
Okay. Well, Jason Van Dyke also told you in the next sentence that the prosecutors didn't read to you, he said that this person looked like a full-grown man to me at that time, correct?
That's what he told me.
Sure. Take your time.
Nothing further. Thanks, Pat.
Mr. Cullum.
Thank you, Chair. You talk about assessing people's behavior. You can't assess people's thoughts with 100% certainty. Is that correct?
No one can assess anything with 100% certainty.
But can we agree that with 100% certainty, people sometimes lie to get themselves out of trouble?
People sometimes do, yes.
And you've testified that you talk to the defendant, and when you're doing a clinical assessment of a patient, it's important for you to be able to tell they're telling the truth, right?
Yes, it is.
But Jason Van Dyke wasn't your patient, was he?
No, he wasn't.
And you're testifying that you can believe him because he was consistent in his story over time. Is that correct?
I can believe that he is not reporting any phenomena that are unusual or atypical, and therefore it speaks to the credibility of what he is telling me. As you correctly point out, there is no 100% efficient lie detection test that you could apply to anybody's statement.
So when he first reported this and he described Laquan McDonald raising a knife above his shoulder...
That's not testimony. There is no testimony that he raised it above his shoulder. The prosecutor knows that. It's over his shoulder.
Rephrase that.
When he told... And I agree. There's
sustain.
There, when he told you he was raising the knife over his shoulder, and I apologize for using the word above instead of over... When he testified, when he said that he raised the knife over his shoulder, you're testifying that that's consistent with him saying, telling you that he claims McDonald only drew it across his chest.
Jason Van Dyke told me that at the time he perceived the subject to draw the weapon across his chest several times. He then told me that in retrospect he realizes now that it was only one time.
So, you're in your view, then he's essentially been sticking to his story. Is that correct?
He's essentially been consistent in telling what he believes happened.
And you believe he's telling the truth because when you were doing a Skype interview with the defendant and his attorney next to you, he stuck with his story, pretty much. Is that your testimony?
All right, so stop the editorializing. All right, rephrase your question.
Is it your testimony that you believe he was telling the truth? I'll withdraw that, Your Honor. I have no further questions.
Thank you very much.
Nothing based on that.
Doctor, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Could I have the attorneys over here very quickly for a schedule?
Talking about scheduling, we don't know if they'll be breaking for lunch, if we're going to get another witness yet today. We had understood there could be two witnesses today, and then there's still the question of Van Dyke himself testifying. Oh, here we go. He's calling the next witness. The defense, we understand, will be calling another witness. Listen.
Ladies and gentlemen, after this witness, we're going to break for lunch. So keep up the good work. Everybody's been very attentive.
Raise your hand. Do you solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony you're about to give before this honorable court and jury shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? Help you guys.
Thank you. Have a seat, detective. The seat's adjustable. The microphone's live. Pull your chair up to the microphone. Speak into the microphone, and we'd be greatly appreciated. So thank you. All right, proceed, Ms. Wynn.
Thank you, Judge. Could you please state your name? Spell your name.
William Johnson, J-O-H-N-S-O-N.
Are you employed?
Yes.
Where?
Chicago Police Department.
What is your current area of assignment?
I'm a detective.
And how long have you been a Chicago Police detective?
I've been a Chicago Police detective for 6 years.
And how long have you been with the department?
I've been with the department for 21 years.
Okay. What are your prior areas of assignment?
8th District, 5th District, 23rd District, Targeted Response Unit, Mobile Strikes Force.
Okay. Detective, I'm going to direct your attention to October 20th, 2014, between the hours of approximately 10 and 11 p.m. Were you working?
Yes, I was.
And were you given an assignment to go to Mount Sinai Hospital?
Yes, I was.
For what?
To follow the ambulance with an offender in it, now known as Laquan McDonald, to update on his condition.
Did you recover any property from Laquan McDonald?
Yes, I did.
Okay. What did you recover?
A disabled transit card belonging to Ernest. I can't remember his last name right now.
Okay, what else?
A venture card, a paper receipt, and an Illinois ID belonging to Laquan McDonald.
It was brought out earlier, so they're just perfecting about who recovered the card.
Okay, I am. May I approach?
Sure.
I'm showing you the privacy numbers 20 through 23. 20. 21, 22, 23. Do you recognize these items?
Yes, I do.
What are these?
These are the items that I recovered from Laquan McDonald.
I'm sorry, you were moving your glasses when the detective was talking. I didn't understand what he said. Go ahead.
I said these are the items I recovered from Laquan McDonald that night.
And are these in substantially the same condition as they were when you recovered them from Laquan McDonald?
Yes.
And what exactly are these?
This is a disabled transit card belonging to Ernest Thomas, Laquan McDonald's Illinois state ID, a venture card, and a white paper receipt.
Thank you. Judge, at this time I'd ask that these be entered into evidence and published to the jury.
Any objections?
I have objection.
What do they tend to prove?
Judge, the detective has testified that they were recovered from the body of Laquan McDonald.
And? All right. Allow the CTA card, because that was mentioned in opening statements.
Thank you. CTA card that you recovered from Laquan McDonald?
Excuse me, hold on 1 minute. Okay. Michael, could you get the other? Pete, get away from it. You got two experts right there, okay? You break it, you own it. Okay, we live then on the monitors. Thank you. All right, proceed, Ms. Wendt.
Thank you, Judge. Is this the card you recovered from the body of Laquan McDonald?
Yes, it is.
And can you tell the jury what it says on this card?
Objection. That's an answer and irrelevant.
Well, it's in evidence already. It's been asked and answered. Move on.
It's an
no, no, Detective, yeah. I told her to move on, not
sorry.
You.
Okay. Do you know who Ernest Thomas is?
No, I do not.
What did you do with all of these documents that you recovered from Laquan McDonald after you recovered them?
I brought them back to Area Central and gave them to Detective Dave March.
When?
All right, what does this prove? He's identified this card as the card that he recovered. So there is it's not necessary to prove up the chain, unless you're going to call Detective March.
No, I just wanted to know why.
Well, he's identified it, so there's no chain of evidence problem. All right.
I have nothing else.
Thank you. State, cross-examination.
Yes, sir. So, Detective, you also recovered other evidence from the person you refer to as the offender, and that was bullets that had riddled the body of Laquan McDonald. Is that correct?
Bullet fragments, yes.
And they were actually, you got those actually from the body as opposed to from his clothing. Is that correct?
I didn't physically take them from his body, no.
Nothing.
Thank you. Thanks. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to break for lunch at this time. So.
All rise for the jury.
All right, so you heard it. Gail Pasetsky, Chicago attorney with me. You defend people in criminal cases. You've also previously, a long time ago, worked in the prosecutor's office. But in terms of defending somebody, this is just about establishing evidence now that he had somebody else's CTA card on his person, Laquan McDonald did that night?
Pretty much. I mean, the defense has put on a few other witnesses to show his bad character. I think that's just adding to the bad character. Judge Gaughan, I think, mentioned in opening statement, the defense has mentioned that the evidence will show that there was a CTA card that did not belong to him in his pocket. And that's something that they're just showing that to say to the jury, you see, we told you it at the opening statement. Here it is now.
And in other defense testimony along the way, they've, for instance, called people from the juvenile detention system who had encounters with McDonald over the years when he was pulled in and being housed overnight, and how he could sometimes become a little bit fired up and wouldn't listen to authority. That there's been that kind of testimony, but then again, some people seem to like him as well. So. Again, just trying to paint a picture for the jury, but what somebody acted like yesterday or the day before, or what they had on their person at that particular moment, you're trying to paint a picture, but at the same time, does it mean they were guilty of something? I suppose that's why the prosecution said you also recovered bullet fragments, and think about that.
Correct. And I think that the witness right beforehand, the doctor, had a bit of a slip, kind of told us, I don't know what he's going to tell you today, meaning Van Dyke. I don't know what Van Dyke is going to tell you today, but this is what he told me when I interviewed him. Does that mean that he
is... Van Dyke is going to testify today?
Right.
Or was that sort of like, well, if I interviewed Van Dyke today yes. This is, could be different? Because he's opening the door there to memory does change over time, as you had pointed out earlier, because we start trying to fill in the blanks the human brain does.
Right, and I don't think that the prosecution did such a great job cross-examining the doctor, because they did not really... They brought up these topics, but very scattered. They asked him some questions. They asked questions about the knife. They asked question about truthfulness, but they didn't really do a great job by putting it in the eyes of the jury, where the jury can feel the time lapse between the original moments of when it's happening until the time that he was interviewing him, and what happened during that gap of time.
Mm-hmm.
Like we mentioned before, there were different reports written. There were different events that were talked about. The defense created a video. How did they create that video? Obviously, they created that video with the input of Van Dyke. I mean, the guy that came and talked to us about the video from California. I think, said, I looked at the report, I watched the original video. He had a few reasons why he created the video the way he did, with inputs. However, Van Dyke, I'm sure, was part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he watched it, for sure, he watched it. So his memory has been building throughout this time. And then eventually he gives his interview or evaluation to this doctor, and the doctor says, well, I can tell that he was truthful because of the events in the past. So really, what were the events in the past? Van Dyke didn't really give too many statements to people. So what did he gauge his evaluation that he was being truthful? I think that the prosecution did not do such a great job in the cross-examination, and the defense did put this doctor, who was pretty effective. He seems knowledgeable. He seems truthful, the mm-hmm. doctor. I think the most damning evidence for the defense through this testimony was the fact that Van Dyke, as he's driving them there to the scene with his partner Walsh, turns to Walsh
twice.
We're
going to have to shoot him, aren't we?
Twice. He says it twice.
But again, the doctor tried to underline that that would have been his analysis of this, was that based on Van Dyke's perception of the scene, having heard the radio traffic of this offender who had already attacked a squad car, slashed the tires, stabbed at the windshield, wouldn't listen to police orders to drop the weapon, that he was seeing it from that perspective. I thought the prosecution probably... Well, it's not really what I think, but they kept hammering home for the jury, I'm assuming, obviously, that a person, though, could lie.
Right.
It's just not 100%, even though you believe he was telling you what he perceived to be the truth. People lie.
Right.
It could be a lie. And the doctor had to admit, well, all of us potentially lie at some point. So, yes, but there were certain criteria he used in his expertise that there was some consistency there and so on and so forth. So, again, the jury can look at this and probably weigh it either way, depending upon what they think about the other evidence in the case, and then take it all as a whole.
Why didn't Van Dyke, if he thought that somebody should shoot McDonald, radio? He has a radio in his car. He heard things over the radio. Why couldn't he radio and say, why, you know, use deadly force or question? Or I don't know. I mean,
well, you can throw that out there, too, as a potential, well, what's going on with that? And I guess if I'm going to counter it, I could say, creating reasonable doubt on the other side, I might say, well, the spur of the moment, so much is happening. They're blocking off at the Burger King. Now they're driving the block off towards the Dunkin' Donuts. And if this stuff happens psychologically, the way the expert described it, we go into time compression and tunnel vision, just human beings in general. But now you're taking a first responder who, as a human being, would want to get away. But as a first responder, you're trained to go in. You've got this conflicting stuff going on, which heightens the sense of the adrenaline and the rush and just everything.
And that puts it in a nice little capsule, what the defense is trying to show.
Trying to show. But again,
right.
Your question would be towards the prosecution side of things. Well, why couldn't he have, you know, reevaluated or used his brain? The doctor talked about the front part of our brain, the frontal lobe that evaluates. That
obviously, he was conducting some sort of an evaluation when he was turning to his partner, Walsh, and talking to him about the events that are happening. He knew, for example, that there was possibly somebody is bringing a taser, according to what he told, which I think might be a memory that was added after the fact. But that's the reason why I'm saying the defense has gained with this witness. The prosecution, I'm not sure, they probably stayed in the same point that they were before, because the cross-examination and the re-cross-examination were not as crisp as they should have been.
Well, it's, I guess it's also difficult, and I had asked Gall this in while they were talking, because there's so many questions to be asked, and it's boom, 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 the next question. Do you ever lose your train of thought? I said, as an attorney there in the courtroom, you are basically interrogating this witness in live court, and now you've got sort of these ideas, and they start talking, and maybe they're going off tangent. You've got to rein them in. Do you ever find yourself thinking, okay, point, get me back?
Okay. So it depends on the tangents that they go off on. So it's not easy to do a cross-examination, mm-hmm. sometimes even the direct examination, because when a witness gives you an answer, you have to do a few things at the same time. You have to listen intently to what they're saying, listen to every word that is coming out of their mouth, because words mean something at trial. And if you catch a witness at saying the wrong word...
Oh, like when they said the knife above or the knife over.
It matters. It matters. It seems like lawyer, you know, just talking and semantics, but it does matter at the end of the day. So if a witness takes you on a tangent, sometimes you want to travel that way on that tangent because it may be good for you.
Sure.
But then you never want to forget where you are heading and where you are going. So I always write down my cross-examinations. You never get to question your witness based on what you write down, because there are tangents and
sure.
the answers are different, but at least it gives you the bullet points to bring you back to the point that you were talking about originally, because that's where you want to come back.
Because you wouldn't want to omit a certain point and then never get to it, so that the jury potentially heard this. So you write it down, but I'm assuming some people go off the cuff, though, too, so I guess they could get pulled away.
I know plenty of lawyers that do not write down anything, and they think that they can do an effective cross-examination, and they might be able to. I'm not saying you can't.
But based on what the psychologist testified about today, it sounds like our brain, you know, could, like, drop out certain areas and forget.
Certainly, yes. And that's why, another thing, I never try a case by myself. I always have, as you can see here, prosecutors always try a case as at least a pair.
Mm-hmm.
And I think defense attorneys should also try cases with at least one more attorney with them, or a team of lawyers, or a team that will help them. Because when you're up there conducting a cross-examination or a direct examination, and you don't have the time to write down the answers.
Mm-hmm.
And if a witness gives you a good answer, or a witness gives you an answer that you want to come back to later on, that's how you rely on what we call your second or third chair, that would take down these points, good points for closing argument, good points to bring out with a different witness eventually, or a good point to bring up later on. Because before you sit down as a good lawyer, you always turn to your table, to your second chair, and you ask him, did I cover everything?
Mm-hmm.
Or you ask her, did I cover everything? Is there anything that I forgot that you wrote down and I need to bring out first?
Well, on some level, I feel like you're making a good case for the defense in terms of police officers in the heat of the moment. They might start doing what they're doing, but now they don't know if there are holes in there, and they might rely on their partner after the fact or other police. Is that too much of a stretch? Because you're putting the attorney under the pressure in the live courtroom scenario. Lots of stuff going on in your head. You're not paying attention to the courtroom. You're trying to focus on the witness. But you know, logically, once it's all said and done, you might have missed something. Maybe you didn't ask the right question the way you turned with it, and you're relying on others to get you back on track.
I didn't kill anyone, though.
Truth be told. All right, Gall. Well, they are taking a break. As you know, they're in the courtroom having a lunch break. So we'll continue with this once they come back from lunch. Obviously, we'll see if they have any other witnesses headed our way.